This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome once again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, this time for our 44th episode. For today's episode, we return to the JCENM to review a recently published study that looks at long-term thionamide use in the treatment of Graves' disease. Over the recent decades, treatment of Graves' disease has been moving away from definitive management with radioactive iodine or thyroidectomy and towards long-term medical therapy. So it will be very helpful to look at data that might support such an approach. As usual for us, this study uses an observational design, so we will think carefully about the inferential methods and how that might affect the author's conclusions. Before I introduce our team today, I will briefly remind you that I have the privilege of hosting the Endocrine Feedback Loop and working at Vanderbilt University as a general endocrinologist and medical director. With us today for the first time and as a regular contributor is Jill Wagner from the University of Colorado, where she too works as a general endocrinologist. At CU, she is an expert educator in the field of endocrinology, serving as the Endocrine Director of House Staff and Student Education and as the lead faculty coordinator for the Endocrine Explained ECHO series. Our guest expert today needs no introduction, but we'll get one anyway. David Cooper comes to us from the Johns Hopkins University, where he is truly one of the world's experts in thyroid disease. He has published extensively and is an in-demand speaker for all topics thyroid. He has long maintained a busy clinical practice and has been frequently recognized for his ability and accomplishments in medical education. So, as you can tell, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me to discuss this article today. As is also always the case, everything we discuss is our opinions only, not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today, we unpack outcomes of patients with Graves' disease 25 years after initiating anti-thyroid drug therapy, which is forthcoming in the Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism. Anne Elin Meling Stokland from Stavanger University Hospital in Norway served as the first author for this paper and was joined by authors from multiple institutions throughout Norway and Denmark. Now I will turn things over to Jill. She will go through the author's introduction and point out the key issues that they raise. She will also get David to give us important insights into Graves' disease that will help us better understand this topic. Jill?
Thanks, Chase. I appreciate you guys having me and I look forward to this discussion. So just to start, Graves obviously is this predominant cause of hyperthyroidism approached with multiple different treatment tactics, typically diagnosed in this hyperthyroid state, typically this thyroid uptake and scan as the kind of older adage of diagnosis, and now moving into the antibody detection in order to streamline that diagnosis. David, can you comment on the upfront baseline for everybody? Where do you see the difference between these TRAb and TSIG antibodies, where they can help us with diagnosis and where that sets us all now compared to what this was 20 years ago?
Thanks for having me. And that's a great question that you're asking. And it really depends on what institution you're working in and what lab facilities are available to you. There are two tests that are used in the diagnosis of Graves' disease now. One is called thyroid receptor antibodies, and the other, as you said, is called thyroid stimulating immunoglobulin. And in general, these are tests that run parallel with one another and are positive in patients with Graves' disease both 90 to 98% of the time. So regardless of which test you get, you're going to be able to diagnose Graves' disease. However, there are occasional patients who are positive for one and not the other, and vice versa. And why that is unclear, but I think in terms of specificity and sensitivity, if you had to pick a test, it would be the thyroid stimulating immunoglobulin test, or TSI, because that test is actually measuring antibodies in the blood that are stimulating thyroid cells or cells that are grown in tissue culture that express the TSH receptor to respond. So they're actually truly measuring stimulating antibodies, whereas the other test, even though it's very good, is just measuring antibodies in general that are present in the blood against the TSH receptor. And these could include antibodies that are neutral and not doing anything, and antibodies even that are blocking the TSH receptor. So the most specific test is the TSI, but either one is fine.
With that baseline, let's get into how treatment for Graves has changed in its landscape over the last number of years. So we have options for anti-thyroid drugs, we have iodine ablation, we have surgical techniques. Lately, anti-thyroid drugs are more commonly used, at least in the initial hyperthyroid state, but other things push us in other directions with intolerance to medications, agranulocytosis, difficulty with medication adherence, all can kind of point us to these other directions. Active thyroid eye disease, also a consideration. And in general, I tend to treat people upfront with anti-thyroid drugs, usually on a goal of a 12 to 18 month timeline, with the hope that I can help them achieve this remission. Can you walk us through where this remission and how antibody levels kind of coincide, especially with us talking just now about the TSIG and TRAb?
So first, I think most people nowadays do what you do, Jill, and that is to start patients on an antithyroid drug rather than moving directly toward what might be called a definitive form of treatment with radioactive iodine or less commonly surgery. And there are data to show that in this country now, at least 75% of patients who have Graves' disease are started on an antithyroid drug as the main treatment. And this brings the U.S. in line with the rest of the world, where we know from surveys that have been done that that is the main treatment for the average patient with Graves' disease. Now, the usual recommendation is to continue the medication, as you said, for 12 to 18, even 24 months, and then measure the levels of the anti-TSH receptor antibodies. And if they are negative, that is, if they're gone, you might say, oh, this patient may be in remission. And I think that some guidelines recommend that you could stop the medication at that point and just monitor the patient. And in fact, some people do relapse after a period of time, but many patients remain normal. On the other hand, if after 18, 24 months of treatment, you measure those antibodies and they're still there, well, then the patient is not in remission and you cannot stop the medicine. Rather, you could say to the patient, well, you have antibodies in your blood, they're still there, and we could either move on to a definitive form of treatment, usually radioactive iodine, or you could continue to take antithyroid drugs for an indeterminate period of time. Again, in the olden days, 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years ago, most patients who had persistent antibodies or who relapsed after the drug was stopped, you know, at some point in the future, were treated with radioactive iodine. But now there is this new concept. I won't say new because, in fact, people even in the 1960s were proposing this, but this idea of long-term anti-thyroid drug therapy rather than moving on to a destructive form of therapy that will leave people permanently hypothyroid. So in that case, if the antibodies are still present or a patient relapses, another option would be to restart the antithyroid drug or continue the drug indefinitely, or at least for a number of years. And I think this is becoming more popular, not just among physicians, but among patients. And patients, in a way, are kind of voting with their feet here. And if you look at data that are coming out, more and more patients are opting for long-term treatment because they prefer an option that does not result in permanent hypothyroidism, and an option that leaves open the window or the door to the idea that maybe someday in the future, it may be 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, but at some point, they'll be in remission and not need to be on any medication at all.
I agree with that. I find that a lot of my conversations with my patients are centered around what's the least that I can do? What's the best chance I have that I can go back to a euthyroid state? And so I'm really excited about this article, because we do have a little bit of a hard time predicting what is going to happen with these folks long term. How do I guide them? For example, I've had patients ask me, I think my mom had thyroid eye disease. I don't have any problems right now. What does this look like for me long term? Can you answer any of those questions for me? And I feel this article kind of helps us at least get some information as to where we can guide our patients further. And so long-term data is kind of lacking about how do we monitor these patients long-term who have been able to achieve remission, who have had to relapse. And so, David, what are your thoughts on people that are in remission off of antithyroid medications, how long should we as endocrinologists see the patient before discharging them back to this PCP realm?
If you look at guidelines that have been written by the ATA or the ETA or any of the other professional societies, no one addresses that question, really. And in a way, it's sort of similar to a question in a patient with thyroid cancer who's doing really well without any evidence of persistent disease, let's say 5 years after their original surgery. Their thyroid globulin levels are undetectable. They have a negative ultrasound. How long does an endocrinologist need to follow that patient? In that case, I recommend that they see their primary care doctor and just make sure they have annual thyroid globulin testing, which some people might even feel is not even necessary, and TSH measurements. And I think it's the same thing for these Graves' disease patients who, let's say after 5 years of monitoring, let's say off antithyroid drugs, so they're in remission and they're still doing well, I think it's reasonable for them to be seen by their primary care doctor. And as you know, even 5 or 10 years later, some people do relapse. And so it's important to obviously document that. And also, as we found out from this paper and other papers too, as I know you'll talk about, some people become spontaneously hypothyroid over time, and that needs to be diagnosed promptly as well. But I don't think endocrinologists need to be the one to be doing this, as long as we're sure that the patients have primary care follow-up.
Another aspect of this that is, I think, more recently being discussed and talked about is how quality of life changes in people that have had thyroid disease. Are treatment options going to predict different outcomes in terms of quality of life? And are those considerations we need to be talking to our patients about from the get-go? Should we be watching for chronic progression of thyroid eye disease? Is there a predictor of populations that we should be watching more closely based on their own individual risk factors? And I know that we have seen quality of life being lower in post-thyroidectomy papillary thyroid cancer cases, and even ATA publications are suggesting this lower quality of life for iodine ablation patients compared to euthyroid post-Graves remission cases. So I think that this article brings up a lot of these questions that are coming to the forefront and how we can discuss treatment of Graves with all of our patients, and brings up a lot of good different questions.
I agree.
That is a perfect segue for us to move into the methods here. So Jill and David have nicely highlighted why we need to be asking these sort of questions. Treatment is evolving. Patients have an interest. Providers have an interest. And we need to understand this as much as possible. We need to be asking these questions. So I think we're really well set up here to dive into this study and to figure out how they answer these questions. First of all, we'll look at the study design here. It's a bit difficult to describe the study design in a single way. I think probably the most helpful way to describe this is to at least start by thinking about this as a retrospective cohort study. I don't think that well describes everything that the authors do here, but we'll at least start with that, and then we can talk about different variations that the authors employ here. So with a retrospective cohort study, we've looked at a lot of these over the past few years, but with these are studies that you have a group overall. So you have a cohort that you are following, and they are split into different categories based on some sort of exposure. So the exposure could be something unique about their disease. It could be a biochemical marker. It could be a treatment that has been used. So a lot of different ways that you can use exposure to split these folks into two, sometimes multiple different groups. And then there has to be a time component for it to be a cohort study. It's a retrospective study, so you are starting the investigation after everything is complete. So you are not following these folks in real time. That's a prospective cohort study. But you do have to be able to establish a clear time sequence so you know when the exposures happen and you know when the outcomes happen. And for some of this investigation here, particularly some of the lab data that we're going to look at, I think that best fits with a retrospective cohort study. I'll comment that not everything is used in that way. Some of the main findings that the authors report really just come from viewing this as a case series. So they have an entire group of patients, and they just describe with simple descriptive statistics, this is how often this happens, this is how often this happens. And that's really just a case series. I think it's still very valuable information, but probably not quite as rigorous as a cohort study would typically be. All right, so now let's think about this investigation in particular. So the patient population here, so this is a unique source of these patients. So this came from an RCT back in the 1990s. So this RCT was from 1997 to 1999, and that study had 218 patients. they were comparing two different treatment approaches. So they had a block and replace approach, and they compared that to a titration regimen. So those were done for 12 months. And then that was followed by an additional 12 months by half of each of those groups taking just levothyroxine or no treatment. And then all of those patients were followed for 2 years after they stopped their antithyroid drugs. And there were a series of blood tests that were drawn that was during the inclusion and also during that follow-up period. So I thought it would be helpful to pause here before we go on with this secondary study and that they've just recently published and think just a little bit more about this RCT. So I thought we could ask David to give us some input here about this RCT, how that was run, important information that came out of that. And in particular, we've talked about antibodies a few times, and David's already alluded to that, that's use of antibodies has changed over time. So how is that done back in the study from the 90s and then contrasted potentially with how we use antibodies now, particularly to determine remission?
Well, even though this was in the 90s, it seems like another era. They actually used antibodies to measure Graves' disease activity, and they were important in this study. The other thing about this study is that it's almost like looking back at history, because back in the 1980s and 90s, there were proponents of this so-called block replace regimen. They felt that if you gave a larger dose of antithyroid drug, made the person hypothyroid, and then replace, quote unquote, them with levothyroxine because they would be hypothyroid, somehow that would be better in achieving remission rates than just giving patients an antithyroid drug and titrating the dose to maintain normal thyroid function. And it was in Scandinavia, especially, that this idea was thought of as something to use in patients. And this randomized controlled trial basically proved that it didn't work. So this was a negative study in the sense that the remission rates were no different after the block replace regimen versus the titration regimen. Now, as Chase said, they did measure antibodies during the study, but because this was the 1990s, I think, they didn't really use the antibodies in a way that we do now. For example, in these patients, they just stopped the antithyroid treatment, whether the antibodies were positive or not. And as you might have predicted, patients who had low or normal antibody levels tended to go into remission and remain normal, whereas patients whose antibody levels were still present at the time the antithyroid drug was stopped tended to relapse much more frequently. So they show that antibodies are important in predicting that if you stop the antithyroid drug when they're still present in the patient's system, the patient's almost inevitably going to relapse back to being hyperthyroid again.
Now, back to this follow-up study, the authors here invited in 2021 all 195 living patients from that initial RCT that David just described for us, and 79% of individuals accepted that invitation to participate. The authors point out that when they compare those who accepted and those who declined to participate, that they couldn't find a difference in sex, in age at disease onset, or in relapse rate. So of 182 total participants, there was lab data that we're going to talk about here in a second from 82 of those people. And for that lab data, the authors also enrolled 82 age and sex match blood donors to use as controls. And we're going to go through that lab data here in the results section. Jill's going to walk us through that here in just a second. As far as the outcomes here, we talked about exposures a little bit before in general, but in particular for the outcomes here, the data was collected through 2022 or death of the subject. That's 23 individuals that was true for. And if labs or self-reported information was inconsistent with other information that the investigators had, then medical records were reviewed. So it wasn't done across the board, but it was done in specific instances where there was worry that there may be some discrepancy. And 136 individuals completed what was referred to as the thyroid-specific quality of life questionnaire. This is what Jill was alluding to before in the introduction about some interesting information that's included here. And I'm going to get David's input again, because I think this is probably a specific device, a specific questionnaire that most of us are not terribly familiar with. So, David, at least on a high level, what can you tell us about this questionnaire? Is this purely a research tool? Does it have any clinical applicability? Or just give us some insight into that.
This is, I think, purely a research tool, but it is a very powerful one, and it has been validated in a number of studies showing that the specific questions that are part of this survey are much more specific and sensitive in terms of ferreting out symptoms that patients with thyroid disease are more apt to have compared to other quality of life studies like the SF-36, for example, which is really a famous one, but is much less sensitive at picking out symptoms that people who have thyroid disease have. And it's called ThyPRO, T-H-Y-P-R-O. I can't remember what that acronym is for, but it tends to be even more sensitive in picking up symptoms in hypothyroid patients compared to hyperthyroid patients compared to the normal population.
And the authors use this questionnaire, and when they get the results, their comparison point is a little bit different. So with the lab data that we talked about before, they have matched controls that they compare the lab data to. This is different. So for this questionnaire, they have access to data from the Danish general population. So David alluded to before already that this was a Scandinavian study. So that was the comparison point. So these were not age and sex match. So we need to keep that in mind as we look at those results. There could be other confounders that could be introduced here as this is just a comparison to a general population. And also, as far as outcomes go, lab data was reviewed, and the authors, because they had some banked specimens, they were able to go back and do additional lab testing. And we're going to go through that. There's quite a few of those, and Jill's going to touch base on those for us. So finally, just briefly on the statistics here. The authors say that their tests were adjusted for age and sex, also corrected for multiple comparisons, quite a few lab information that has to be adjusted for here, and that the models that they use were adjusted for the antibody level, so specifically that's the TRAb, and then also the patient's smoking status. So David, just before we wrap up the stats and the methods in general here, any other confounders? I know there can be a lot when we think about those, but besides those ones that were mentioned there, anything else that maybe the author should have kept in mind, or pretty good list here for what we know tends to drive Graves' disease?
Yeah, I couldn't think of anything else that they should have controlled for other than what they already did.
All right, excellent. With that, we will move on to our results section. So Jill's got a lot of information to go through. So she's going to do this first at a bit of a granular level, and then is going to give us some nice summary of these results before we actually go through the author's discussion. So Jill, take it away.
I think it's helpful to get some of the results from that original data, just to kind of set this landscape a little bit better. So in the initial study, after that 12 months of treatment, whether it was the block and replace method or the titration of antithyroid drug method, a little bit more than 47% had a relapse. And in that kind of microcosm of those that had relapsed, they were able to extrapolate that it was associated with those that had a larger goiter, higher titer of the TRAb antibodies, active smoking status, all of those had the higher risk of relapse. In the group, though, that had attained remission after the 12 months of either form of antithyroid drug therapy and then stopped, the people that had initially undergone remission, a large proportion was able to maintain a euthyroid, normal thyroid function 20 years out. And so while there was a pretty high risk of relapse in the initial group, those that had the good outcome initially, 62% of those were able to be medication-free in this euthyroid state, even after just experiencing 12 months worth of the antithyroid medication. Of the 78 that got this remission from the original study, only 11 people went on to require more definitive therapy and ended up being about 14% total were subsequently requiring an escalated level of treatment after the initial remission phase. Interestingly, in this group that had initially attained remission, there is a higher rate of spontaneous hypothyroidism, where 21% of those that had originally attained remission developed thyroid replacement therapy for treatment. They went on to say that most of those cases were associated with a simultaneous positive TPO antibody, and only one in this population required restart of antithyroid drugs for long-term maintenance. So about two-thirds able to maintain that remission state, but did have a higher proportion of hypothyroidism. On the flip side, those who had the relapse after that initial treatment, the initial study, at 20 years out, only 11% were able to maintain a euthyroid state without medication. And so in this initial group that had the relapse up front, as was the style of the time, 65% went on to require an ablation therapy and a subsequent 17% required surgery. So a much higher proportion of the 20 years after the initial study ended up with definitive treatment. And at 20 years out, only 3 of the original 82 that relapsed were still on antithyroid drugs, which I think alludes to the time changes of how we approach these as relapses. There was a lower proportion of hypothyroidism in this group, with only 6% going hypothyroid without ablation, but still they alluded that majority of those patients had the positive TPO antibody, where collectively, out of 23 patients that developed hypothyroidism after a Graves diagnosis, 21 of them had a positive TPO. So pretty significant crossover there. The study additionally tried to associate inflammatory markers and get a direction of if any of these were more associated apart than just the TRAb or the TPO. The TRAb seemed to correlate with one of the tumor necrosis factor RSF9, but unfortunately did not predict a relapse state when adjusting for the TRAb titer or for smoking. They also looked at IL-6 and found it was associated with relapse, but CD40 was not. And as for thyroid eye disease, there was a high proportion, I felt, in the initial study population in 1997 with what was reported as mild to moderate thyroid eye disease, where 43% of the initial population had reported thyroid eye disease. And over the subsequent time, only one patient had new thyroid eye disease at the time of relapse. And in the 20 subsequent years, 10 more patients out of 103 developed new thyroid eye disease. So this alludes to a lower proportion of new thyroid eye disease over that long-term follow-up, most of these being after an iodine ablation. In general, 43% of people with thyroid eye disease on diagnosis of Graves' disease had a higher likelihood of relapse and persistent disease after that 12 months of initial antithyroid drug therapy. This study also tried to extrapolate some other factors and other associated conditions with Graves' disease. They screened for other autoimmune comorbidities, and at the end of the original study in 1999, they found that only 6% of the group had another simultaneous autoimmune comorbidity, but this jumped up to 47% after the full 20 years of the study, with the most common being B12 deficiency, which we'll discuss a little bit of a pearl later of why that may have been. A quarter of these autoimmune issues were attributed to B12 deficiency, and the next most common were hypothyroidism and rheumatoid arthritis, coming in at 5% representation each. And relapse, interestingly, was not associated with the presence of a second autoimmune condition. Last, they discussed the quality of life questionnaire via the ThyPRO that we discussed earlier, and found almost 20% of individuals requiring long-term health leave or disability due to their thyroid disease, where hypothyroidism from any cause had the most significant impact on quality of life with the largest symptom burden, where iodine ablation and surgery were comparable to each other and less severe than the hypothyroidism itself from TPO or iodine ablation cases. So I'll let David speculate on why we think there is this higher prevalence of quality of life impact with the hypothyroidism. Is it because that questionnaire is most specific to that state, or is there something else there that actual hypothyroidism is more severely tolerated than surgery?
First of all, this is not the first study to show that patients with treated Graves' disease, either after radioiodine or surgery, have worse quality of life than the general population. Also worse quality of life than people after long-term antithyroid therapy. There are a couple of other studies that have shown this as well. The strange thing about this study was the people who developed spontaneous hypothyroidism, in other words, after going into remission, they just became hypothyroid, had worse scores than the people that were hypothyroid after radioiodine or surgery. And I think that's the question you're asking, Jill. Why would this be? I have no idea. It just makes no sense to me whatsoever. Why would that be? They're all hypothyroid. They're all taking levothyroxine. If anything, the patients who have had radioiodine and surgery are more ablated and more dependent on thyroid medication than the people that were spontaneously hypothyroid, who still probably have some residual minor degree of endogenous thyroid output of thyroid hormone, including T3, if you want to even argue about that. I don't know the answer, honestly. It doesn't make any sense to me, but that's what they found.
I'm glad I'm not alone in that consensus.
As I said, other studies have shown the same thing, although they didn't have a group that had become spontaneously hypothyroid in these other studies I'm referring to.
In summary, I threw out a lot of numbers, but the initial remission after 12 months of antithyroid drugs has the highest association with post-treatment euthyroid state, with about two-thirds of people being able to be off of medication completely in a euthyroid state 20 years out from initial treatment. In the relapsed population, more than 80% of those people required a definitive ablation or surgery. Though I will put the caveat out that we do approach things a little bit differently later. The term requiring definitive therapy might be a little bit loosely mentioned, where maybe now we could have continued antithyroid drugs. But at its core, more than 80% of the people who relapsed initially required some form of additional therapy. And that the TRAb and smoking seem to be the highest biochemical and exposure-related relapse cause. As a whole, those with thyroid eye disease on presentation are more likely to have a relapse. In those who did develop new thyroid eye disease over the 20-year timeframe, this was only about 10% of the population, and 70% of those, majority of those patients, had so after an ablation. Additionally, with the quality of life being most impacted by hypothyroidism, again, we mentioned that this is from this autoimmunity, this spontaneous hypothyroidism, as opposed to having one of the definitive treatments otherwise.
Excellent work, Jill, and wrestling with a bunch of numbers here and presenting them for us. Now we're going to move on to the discussion here. And in addition to highlighting some of these numbers again, we're really going to start trying to wrestle with those, give you our thoughts on that, and how this might ultimately change the care that we provide to our patients. So first of all, yet again, to recap some of the numbers here, the main points that the authors make from their study and their discussion is that one, about a third of patients end up with normal thyroid function, those with Graves' disease, only a third. And then also of that group, about 50% develop other autoimmune conditions. Third conclusion is that 10% of individuals with Graves' disease develop treatment requiring thyroid eye disease. And then finally, for those with Graves' disease, if you are trying to determine predictors of relapse, the best predictors appear to be smoking status, thyroid eye disease, and an age less than 40. So a few other points that we want to make along the way, and just highlighting what the authors point out, is that in those who go into remission by 2 years, only two-thirds had normal thyroid function after 25 years, and 9% relapsed 10 years or more after their primary diagnosis. And so as we've talked about before, while this is something that you could consider handing off to a primary care provider, there is long-term monitoring that's needed because a lot of individuals will go years before they recur, even though they will eventually do that. The authors point out that guidelines variably recommend radioactive iodine or antithyroid drugs as first-line therapy. And I'm going to quote something that the authors say here because I want to get David's input on this. And so they say, quote, "Our data support that long-term antithyroid drug treatment now is a more common approach." So, David, help me wrestle with that. We're going to talk about this a little bit more, but very few of the patients in the study were actually treated long-term. As Jill has pointed out, usually after trying antithyroid drug treatment, if they relapse, then typically it is a movement towards definitive therapy here because this was a few years ago. So help me understand just a little bit more about what the authors might be drawing from or why they're making this conclusion.
I think what they're saying is they say, yes, our data support that this is a really good idea. I think that's what they're saying. In other words, we didn't do this in our cohort from Denmark. You can see that most people didn't do that. When they relapsed, they were treated with surgery or radioactive iodine. But what these authors, I believe, are saying is now this approach of what might be called long-term antithyroid drug therapy seems more reasonable if you look at the quality of life survey, I think, is really what they're focused on, and how the quality of life is different and less good than the general population and less good than the patients who are being maintained on antithyroid drugs. In other words, patients who are not in remission but are on long-term antithyroid drug therapy have the same quality of life as normal, healthy people. I think that's what they're saying. Also, I think, just if I might add one other thing, they mentioned that radioactive iodine was associated with a significant incidence of thyroid eye disease beyond what occurred, as we all know, in the initial cohort before they were treated with radioactive iodine. And the majority of patients that required surgery for their eye disease were the ones that had an exacerbation after radioactive iodine therapy.
David, those are both very helpful comments. And I think in particular, it is important to nuance because the authors make a few different comments here about their data supporting long-term treatment medical therapy. And I think it's important to highlight exactly how it supports it. I think they have some data that suggests that it's a very reasonable approach. But as we go back to the methods and think about the groups that are actually studied here, there are very, very few patients who actually have long-term treatment with antithyroid medication. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind here, is that is not a comparison group for the most part. They do have a handful of people, but very few individuals underwent that treatment strategy. So we don't know that for sure. We can look at this data and see, yes, there are problems that appear to show up with some of these other approaches, but we can't automatically assume that a different approach that's not studied very well here is going to be better. So we'll come back to that as we wrap up and think about how this should change our practice. Getting a little bit more into the details around the lab data here, Jill already mentioned them for us, but we're going to come back to them. So the authors point out that particularly two of the markers that they looked at, so specifically TNF, SF9, and then also IL-6, could serve as predictive markers. And I guess a question that I had, David, I'm going to get your input again here, is they are looking for predictive markers beyond the antibodies. And I guess my question is given what the antibodies are, that they are actually very specifically drivers of Graves' disease itself, do we need other markers beyond that, particularly if they don't seem to be quite as good as the antibodies themselves?
You know, I don't know. It's hard to predict the future. And I think that, as we all know, as clinicians and people who treat patients with thyroid disease, on the horizon, there probably are other treatments for Graves' disease that are not drugs that basically poison the thyroid and prevent it from making thyroid hormone. There are going to be drugs that are coming out that are going to be used to treat the cause of Graves' disease, either by affecting antibody production or by affecting binding of the antibody to TSH receptor or by other means. And although measuring the anti-TSH receptor antibody still is going to be a cornerstone of monitoring, it may be that some of these other inflammatory markers might turn out to be useful in the monitoring of patients who are taking other treatments. I predict that in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, there are going to be other treatments for Graves' disease that go far beyond what we're doing now. And I think that it may be that there will be other tests that will be used to monitor that. I can't rule that out at all.
The authors point out something that David mentioned a few minutes ago about the prevalence of thyroid eye disease. So in general, it is around 40%, in line with what's been seen elsewhere. The authors helpfully point out, and Jill mentioned this at the very beginning, that there's a question that's often asked, that if there is not thyroid eye disease at baseline, it's unlikely to develop over the course of Graves' disease. And if it's mild at baseline, it's unlikely to progress unless, as David pointed out, radioactive iodine is given. That is one factor that could lead to progression that may actually require significant intervention. To go back to another point that we've talked about already about the prevalence of autoimmune conditions coexisting with Graves' disease, the authors point out that that's very common, in particular that B12 deficiency was highly overrepresented. I'll mention as an aside here, you always have to be worried about the possibility of an ascertainment bias here, because this is an observational study. These other conditions were not looked for the same in one group versus another. And it's very possible that, say, primary care providers, knowing that their patients have an autoimmune disease, they are far more attuned and far more aggressive in looking for coexisting autoimmune conditions. So that that could be part of why these other ones are found. Now, it would not at all be surprising if, in fact, B12 deficiency is far more likely here, but it may not be as overrepresented as is suggested here because of the possibility of an ascertainment bias.
I believe when they were screening for people to put into this cohort of people that had B12 deficiency, they found that number based on who was on B12 replacement. So I don't know if the times of wanting to give a lot of people B12 without necessarily screening up front has always been a story, but I wonder if that also inflated those numbers as well.
Finally, we'll wrap up here with some of the authors' limitations that they point out. So one, the authors list that they don't have clinical activity scores for their patients with thyroid eye disease. So there are some limitations on the details that they're able to present. They point out that it is at least possible that the quality of some of the samples that were banked for 20 years could be an issue that they thought it was likely or unlikely to be a major issue for them. The authors also point out that there was a chance of just chance findings with analyzing 92 biomarkers, and that also that smoking could have potentially confounded that. And then finally, something that we've talked about already, they do point out that there is a rarity of long-term antithyroid drug treatment or use of a second course of an antithyroid drug with a relapse. And then we pointed out some of the concerns there, and it's how it's hard to understand given that limitation. Okay, so the author's conclusion. So what I would describe as the summary that they provide for their findings is that only one-third of Graves' disease patients obtain normal thyroid function, and many develop hypothyroidism and permanently reduce quality of life, either spontaneously or secondary to ablative treatment. And how I would describe a couple of statements that the authors make would be implications. And one that they suggest is that longer antithyroid drug treatment may be beneficial treatment approach, and that clinical guidelines should consider recommending long-term antithyroid drug treatment as a standard approach. So we're going to wrestle this with this as we wrap up. So Jill, let's start with you. Just give me your thoughts on the overall quality of this report, as I know you spent a lot of time reading this and thinking through the details. What are your thoughts on overall quality?
I appreciate what they were doing with this study. I think it is a number of questions that we don't have good answers for, and they did their best in a population that was already well decided, pretty homogenous, able to give us some sort of predictors that we can utilize to inform our patients of what we think is going to happen. So I appreciated this study. I did find it interesting that currently I look at my patients with Graves, and if they do have both TRAb and TPO positive, I associate that with a higher chance of undergoing remission. But I did not necessarily understand how likely they then would be to develop spontaneous hypothyroidism. And that's something that I don't necessarily coach them on up front, but I think that I would like to start implementing.
It's already some ideas about how this could be changing the clinical practice and in the care that you provide for your patients. David, thoughts on overall quality of this report?
I thought the authors did a good a job as they possibly could have with the material and the patients and the data that they had. What was amazing to me, really, and this is true, I think, of a lot of Scandinavian studies, is the fact that they were able to track down all these people a quarter of a century later. In other words, they were still living where they lived or had the same phone number. It's just amazing. I don't think that if we had a study that was done in the 1990s and we wanted to see how everybody was doing, we'd be able to do this. People are much more mobile, I think, maybe in the United States. So this is not unique. I mean, other studies have also tracked down people who were participating in randomized controlled trials just like this, mostly in Europe and Scandinavia. And then just to echo what Jill said, I think we underappreciate the likelihood that people will undergo and become spontaneously hypothyroid who are in remission. This is something that has been described. It was described in the 1970s by Ingbar, but this really drives it home, I think. And although, to be honest with you, I used to think that measuring TPO antibodies in people with Graves' disease was sort of a waste of time. You know, maybe it's not. I think maybe it does allow us to predict that those are the people that are going to go on and maybe become hypothyroid in the future.
And David, let's stick with you here as we wrap up and think about changing our clinical practice. You've been at the thyroid game for a while. You speak on this a lot, write on this a lot, help with guidelines. How do you see this? Should this information change our practice? Does it continue to move us in a certain direction? Does it not particularly move us forward? How would you think that this might guide the care that we provide for our patients?
It's like looking at a daguerreotype of Abraham Lincoln when he was president. I mean, this is just, you know, data that happened 20 years ago, and this is what happened to all the people. This is not how we treat hyperthyroidism nowadays. And, you know, you'll see from data from the Mayo Clinic and other studies that, as was pointed out, when people relapse now, they are not treated with radioactive iodine and surgery anymore. It's much, much more common for a person to restart an antithyroid drug. So I think all this study is interesting and, you know, gives us lessons about what is likely to happen if you treat people in a certain way. I don't think this is in accord with what people are doing now. But do you agree with what I'm saying, Chase, at your own institution?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I think this gives us more information that supports some of the concerns that can go along with some of the older forms of treatment. And I think we'll just continue to support and build that case for the benefit of long-term antithyroid drug treatment. Even if this one didn't directly look at that, I do agree with the authors that it does provide some additional support that argues that we are moving in the right direction with the shifts that we have seen in our treatment. And with that, I would like to thank Jill Wagner and David Cooper for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.